Mastermind Agent is proud to present the Interview of the Month Club. Top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Cerrone with Mastermind Agent. This month's top agent is Daniel Del Real with PMZ Inc. in Modesto, California. He works the Central Valley. Last year, he closed 196 transactions with a total sales volume of $25 million. His average sales price was $131,000. 54% were buyers and 46% were sellers. He operates a team with four members, one closing manager, one buyer agent, one REO partner, and one team leader. Daniel Del Real is the team leader of the Del Real Group. He has been an agent for 8 years. Daniel specializes in generating referral business from his database of past clients and sphere of influence. He receives over 80% of his business from referrals. Daniel is very selective about who goes into his database and who stays in. He's not afraid to remove names of people who are not referring him business. He only wants to invest his time and effort with people who believe in him and send him referrals. Daniel believes it's better to have 100 people in his database who are actively referring him business than to have 1,000 people who may or may not. Daniel stopped advertising a few years ago. He redirected all the money into improving his relationships with people in his database. After 8 years, he has a database of 800 people who referred over 160 transactions last year. How does he do it? Daniel believes he must be a selfless giver. Through the magic of reciprocity, the more he gives, the more he receives. Daniel prefers to educate or show people how transactions work rather than selling or telling them. To this end, Daniel created transactional case studies for buying, selling, investing that he posts on his blog. Daniel added REO volume to his business by partnering with a successful veteran agent. Listen carefully to how Daniel is building his exit strategy. Welcome to the call, Daniel.
Hello, Mike.
Daniel, before we get started into what you're doing today, let's go back for a minute and talk about what you did before you got into real estate.
Well, I spent 4 years in the Air Force. Shortly after that, I started my real estate career. I have my degree in criminal justice. I was gonna go into that sector, but my parents have been long time investors in real estate, and my mom kind of nudged me into the business, and 8 years ago, and it's been history since then.
Did you have a fast start or a slow start?
I had a fast start just because when I came back from the Air Force, it was sink or swim. You know, didn't have much of a savings. I had another career which I ended up leaving for real estate, so I told myself I am going full steam ahead for a solid 6 months to see if it's something that is going to be that's going to fit me, if I'm going to be passionate about it. And so I gave it all I had for the first 6 months, and then from there it just kind of just blew up.
You're in Modesto, California. Where is Modesto, California?
It's in the Central Valley, California. We're basically one of the capitals of the foreclosure market.
Describe your current market.
The market here has been stagnant for the last 18 months. So prices jump up and down from month to month. Inventory's low. Most listings out here now are REO sales or short sales. We're starting to see a little more of the traditional sales or the flippers, people that are rehabbing homes. You can put down the average price of Modesto is about $130,000.
Do you know your average days on the market?
45 days. Yeah, it's fast. With low inventory, homes are selling. You know, rates are still really low. You know, buyers have this great opportunity now to purchase a house in the median price and actually pay less than they do in rent. So investors are the same way. You know, they put 20% down on a property that's $130,000. They're positive cash flow is 10 to 15% a year. So just on positive cash. So it keeps the market pretty busy and keeps inventory fairly low.
Do you have a niche or a specialization in that market?
Yeah, I deal a lot with buyers. You know, I'm on the buyer end quite a bit, more than the listing end. It's, my numbers are very close. If you look at my numbers, I believe it's maybe 40% of my transactions are listings and 60% of those are buyer transactions. So it's hard to say where's my niche because I think I'm pretty well balanced across the board. But we're basically doing it all. We do have some REO business in our inventory, listing inventory, which on our listing inventory maybe accounts for 20% of our listings. We have a short sell inventory, which also accounts, well, that accounts for a bit more, maybe about 50% of our inventory. And the other 30% is a private party. With the buyer end, we do a lot with first-time buyers. And we are helping a lot of investors purchase property in the Central Valley right now.
How are you generating leads in business?
We deal mostly with referral business. It's very rare for me to take a client on that's not referred to me. Usually if it's a cold lead that comes in on, say, the internet or a signed call, whatever else we have out there, it usually shifts over to my buyer's agent, which is also my brother, Enrique, and he works with them. You know, for the most part, we're referral business based.
What percentage of your business do you think is referral?
I would say anywhere from 65 to 75% of the business is referral.
That's a big percent.
Yeah, it is. It makes coming to work a lot funner when you have a relationship or somewhat of a relationship with the person that you're working with. We don't mind firing a client if we don't work well with them, if they don't work well with us. We get to select a bit more who we work with and control our environment.
How are you generating so many referrals?
Yeah, the number one thing is the database. You need to keep track of everything that goes in there. And we don't put anybody in the database. We need to have a good relationship with you, or actually close a transaction with you. So when you're closing, you know, 200 transactions a year, your database gets big fairly quick. What I tell my brother is I want to get a referral from at least 30% of our, you know, of our closed sales from the following year for the next year. So it tends to keep revolving the business over, and we keep track of them through a database software, it's called ACT, which is not the best software, but it works well for us. We could categorize clients to A clients, A clients being people that love to refer, B clients, people that wouldn't go out of the way to refer us, but are still great clients that we've done business with. We have a family and friend section. We have an investor section. And we also subcategorize clients by their transaction, whether we did a purchase, whether we did a sell, whether they bought an investment property, or whether they're a first-time buyer. So if I go in there and do a search of all the properties that we've closed, I could categorize them by date that we closed and kind of create a follow-up system from there.
What type of information do you like to collect on each person?
Well, you know, you collect the simple stuff, contacts, whatever you end up collecting while you're working with them. Whenever you're working with somebody, it's very rare that you work with somebody for less than 60 days, you know, whether you're buying a house or selling a property. So, you know, with my conversations with my clients or my assistant's conversations with my clients or my brother's conversations with my clients, we tend to talk more personal with them. So if we know they have kids, if we know they like a certain restaurant, if we know they like to do a certain thing, that all goes in under our notes, under their contact in our contact management software. And we all have access to that contact management software through different technology systems that are out there, like LogMeIn.com or, you know, we could have access to all their files if they were closing it through Dropbox or things like that. So we all have access to change that or look into whatever, you know, if they had a closing or whatnot, if we need to look up, you know, how the transaction went or if they had a home warranty or whatnot. We all track it on one system.
How big is your database? How many names are in there?
Names of solid people that we've done business with that we haven't, because not everybody stays in the system. If somebody's been in the system for 3 years that we've helped purchase a property and we know that they've just haven't had very well good rapport with us, they haven't really responded to our personal notes or calls or anything like that, they'll get dropped off. And in my system right now, solid people that I've done business with that actually refer business to me, about 800.
How long did it take you to build the list of 800?
8 years.
How do you build that list? How did you start the list and how did you add to the list?
Well, it started small. You know, when I came here, I left for 4 years, so I didn't keep in touch with a lot of people. So initially, it was just my sphere and my family. And I started like any other agent, you know, doing open houses, you know, walking neighborhoods, sending flyers out, putting newspaper ads. And I just slowly started building that database. You know, I've been fortunate that, you know, the luckier, the harder I worked, the luckier I got. So I was able to build that database quickly because I was, you know, closing at the beginning, you know, 30, 40, 60, and just quickly jumped up to 100, 200 transactions a year. So, you know, I was able to build that fairly quick.
Basically, the way someone gets added to your list is if they have a closing with you or they become a close personal contact.
Yes, not everybody we talk to goes into our database right away. If say you were a referral, and you're either a buyer or a seller, even if you're, you know, say for instance a buyer, you know, you go into, and it's the old school way of doing it, and I know people don't like it, but I use Microsoft Outlook. It's great. It's been working for me forever. I'm not going to complicate my life more than it should be, so I still use it. And I put them in my Microsoft Outlook, and they stay in my calendar in my face every single day until they're closed. And as soon as they're closed, they don't appear on my screen every day. They end up going into my ACT, categorized, and then the follow-up system is set in place. And they disappear from my Outlook until I actually have to do my, say for a buyer or a seller, my 1 month follow-up call after the close of the 6 month, of the year, the 2 year, they'll keep popping up on my Outlook. But so to answer your question, initially they don't make it to my permanent database. They initially are in my Microsoft Outlook system for at least a month to 2 months before I know, okay, I either close on them, or if for some reason we ran into an obstacle where we couldn't get them financed, or we have a good relationship, but something happened. If we have that good relationship, which I know is gonna, you know, we're gonna do something with them, or they could bring some value to our business, and I'll end up going into my contact management software. But initially, everybody goes into Microsoft Outlook, and they eventually migrate. You know, the cream of the crop basically migrate into my contact management software.
So you basically have two databases. You have your leads, prospects, people you're working with right now, and then you have your solid referral database that you're going to put into ACT. So you have Outlook and then ACT.
Yes.
After somebody becomes a past client, they go into your ACT. They look like they're going to be strong for you in the future.
Mm-hmm.
How are you generating these referrals? You must be staying in touch with these people. How are you doing that?
We do several things. For instance, buyers, we do follow-up calls a month, 6 months, and a year. We send out anniversary cards in the first year of homeownership. My assistant usually coordinates that. I try to make it as automatic for me because I have other things to worry about, like generating business or, you know, finding buyers or selling people's homes. So. She usually goes into the database daily, looks to see who I closed and when I closed them, or when somebody is set for their month or 6 months or a year follow-up. And she'll either help me generate the letter that I would sign, or she would leave a list on my desk so I could make phone calls. So that's something that that I do to, you know, keep in touch with them. I also subscribe to a magazine that's called Home by Design, which I love because it's a passive advertising basic magazine, which lets me modify the magazine any which way I want. So it's a 30-page magazine my clients get every 3 months from me. And it's great because they see my name on the cover and on the inside. As soon as they open it, I usually have a really, really personal section where it describes what I think of the market, but not only that, but how my family relates to the market. You know, whether not just the general market, but the season, or say, for instance, my family and I went on a family vacation in March. So my April magazine had pictures of my family on vacation, and I usually have like a quote to help my clients say, seize the moment when they go on vacation, or when you're on vacation, be 100% present on your vacation and enjoy your kids. So I get a little more personal on that, and that's a little more of a passive thing that I do. Another cool thing that we started doing, which I don't know why everybody doesn't do this, and it works fantastic for us when we started doing it. It's a bit bizarre, but we usually used to spend $500 to $1,000 a month on different sources of advertising, whether it was online through, say, Trulia, Zillow, the Google, or newspaper-based ads. And what we did is we stopped all of it. You know, just because we were just getting so many referrals, the ads or the calls that we were getting from the ads or the online websites, we weren't as receptive to them because, of course, you know, if you have a soft, warm client and you have a very cold client that's going to take, you know, have that rapport with, of course, you're always going to go with that soft client. If you're really busy with it, then you have to focus on why you're really busy with it and, you know, make that grow. So what we did is we stopped all advertising about 2 years ago or so. And I started spending purposely, I said $500 a month. I was going to do half of my budget. And I was going to do $500 a month, and I went out to a grocery store, and I bought, I went to their gift card rack, and I bought gift cards to most of the large restaurants in our city, movie theaters, Home Depot. 1 month I did a bunch of gas cards when the gas started going bonkers, coffee cards. And so I have a stack of gift cards, and every time we get a referral from somebody, not when we close, but right when we get the call saying, hey, you know, I'm going to refer somebody to you, or we get a call from that referral saying so-and-so referred me to you, they instantly get a personal note and a gift card. It could be $25, it could be $50, but it's something from us. And that, believe it or not, people were returning calls like crazy, thanking us, saying how awesome it was, you know. Another thing we spent money on as well is we have season tickets to our world champion San Francisco Giants, something that was always dear to my heart going to baseball. So that's something that also allows me to call my database depending on who I want to reach and saying, hey, I got tickets to the Dodgers game today. Would you like to go? Then they'll come into my office, or I'll drop off the tickets to their office, and it gives me a reason to call them of value. I'm usually the giver, which when you find people that enjoy that, they tend to give back. And when you find those people, when you're usually giving to them, they'll end up saying, I owe Daniel something. I need to give him something. I need to find somebody. And they make it, they get excited about it, you know, because they know that you're thinking about them. And in return, they're always thinking about you.
Reciprocity.
Yeah, so love it. Pay it forward. Do it without expecting something back. That's what I tell everybody. Look, you know, I send these gift cards out. I do all these other things. And I don't, you know, people see that. If I don't expect anything back, you know, you don't have that over you, you know. So you give selflessly, and it usually comes back for you twofold. I mean, that's just the way I kind of do business, and I think people notice that, so they feel really comfortable with it.
So when you make these follow-up calls and offer the tickets, you're not asking for a referral.
you know, I'm softly asking for referral, you know, so I call somebody and our conversation might be, you know, might be a minute. If my conversation is only a minute, I'm not asking for a referral, you know, because that means it's not, you know, if you're going to ask for a referral, your conversation needs to be over 2.5 minutes. And it usually has to be a little bit of relevance with whatever's going on in their life. And then you'll throw in at the end of it, hey, you know, they'll usually ask you because they care. They'll say, hey, Daniel, how's everything going? Everything's going fantastic. By the way, thanks so much for all your referrals, whether they have referred anybody or not, you know, but you throw it out there. You just thank them, you know. They might say, hey, I never referred somebody to them. Maybe I should look. But that's usually how I end it. I softly ask for it, but I do ask for it.
So you ask for it by making an assumptive statement by saying, thank you for sending me your referrals.
Yeah, thank you for trusting in me these last couple of years. I really do appreciate all the help that you bring to my business. And, you know, and usually it comes with, you know, just a simple chat about family, or it comes with, you know, here's some tickets to some Giants game, or, you know, usually they'll call me back for, you know, when they're calling me back because I sent them a gift certificate to some certain place, it's usually because they did refer somebody to me. And those are the people I really want to keep asking, because those are the people that are actually, you know, saying my name to their family and friends. You know, it's better to have, you know, 10 or 20 or 100 people that love you, and every chance they get, they're telling you, I know Daniel, and he's a great agent, and you need to talk to him, you know, than having 1,000 people that maybe might or might not refer you, might not know your name. So I'd rather focus on those 100 qualified A-plus people that are excited to give my name than to really focus on the 1,000 that don't.
Do you see a concentration of a certain group of people in your 800 database that send the majority of the referrals?
You know, it's a variety of people. I have a lot of the first-time buyers are very excited. They love to refer people to me. A lot of the young, you know, the people that weren't buying homes when the market was going bonkers, that are, you know, in their low 20s to mid-20s to, you know, just getting out of college, they love to refer people. We're in a society of contacts, and sometimes you're excited about the people that you know, and they're excited to know me and to be in the business and the way I do business. So I see that they refer a lot of people to me.
Any other secrets to generating referrals out of your database?
No, I mean, I think the biggest secret is investing in that database. You know, focus on the people that have done business with you and are happy with you. So if you're going to spend $500 on a newspaper ad or whatever kind of ad that's going to maybe touch a bunch of other people that might never call you, you know, try it for 1 month. You know, stop that and spend that money in the people that you've done business with, not expecting anything back, and you'll be amazed what happens.
In your letters and your postcards that you're sending out, or your thank you cards, do you make any reference to referrals in those cards?
Yeah, just about all of them.
How is it referenced?
I put, you know, on one side of the card, they're all personal cards that I make. You know, for instance, if I close a transaction with somebody, whether it's a seller or buyer, I do something a bit quirky. I have my own cards that say on the front, and I've been using this forever, and I'll keep using it because, you know, I've been to buyers' homes or sellers' homes, and I've seen the card on their mantle like a reminder that this is what they did. And it says, a house is built by wood and beams. A home is built by hopes and dreams. And in the inside it says, congratulations, and I write a personal note of our, you know, of our experience. And then on the other side, I do put a quick little note. By the way, if you know anybody that's looking to buy a property or get some real estate advice, please give them my card. I'll include a couple cards. And then I'll stuff the heck out of that envelope with confetti. So usually it generates a call because they'll open it up and I'll flip the card upside down and the confetti will go all over the place. So it's usually a pretty funny conversation whenever they get back to me, you know. But I always ask for it on their 6-month letter, or if I call them and I send them a personal note, or if somebody refers somebody to me, I'll put a quick note in there, and then on the inside flap I always put, you know, thank you for your referral, and I'll include a couple other business cards. So I always ask for it.
you talked about when they first close, you try to get in touch with them 1 month, 6 months, 12 months. How far out do you schedule your contact with them?
I usually do up to a year, and then I'll put them, well, when they're in my year, they also go into my my regular follow-up systems. Like, they'll get my Thanksgiving card. I have a personal Thanksgiving card, which I sign a ton of them. My Christmas card, my personal family Christmas card, they also get. And then most of them are also in that passive magazine that I send out as well. So it's something that they hear from me on paper at least three times, like solid, you know, heartfelt, you know, mailings, like Thanksgiving card or a Christmas card or my magazines that actually have personal things in there. And then I'll tend to call them as well. Or, you know, if they're good clients, they tend to call me. So my phone's constantly ringing with people that want to talk. So I always want to make that time to do that. But to answer your question, after that year, they go into the more passive, indirect, kind of direct marketing that we have, the Christmas cards, the Thanksgiving cards, my magazines, and also, you know, hopefully we'll stay in touch because if I'm calling them with tickets to the Giants game or thanking them for referrals or just calling them to see how they're doing. I have my assistant. She also makes a list of 10 random people, and she sets them on my desk, and I call them every week, you know, just to kind of say, hey, how you doing, you know, talking to people.
So you try to make 10 random calls per week on top of everything else you're doing.
Yeah. Just the people that I haven't, maybe I closed 2.5 years ago, maybe haven't been as active. When I make that call, if I see, hey, we kind of weed them out a little bit too. If I haven't had much response to them and say they don't answer my call and they don't call me back, and I try to give them a call again, they don't answer me back, and I tried a couple times and I just didn't, you know, sometimes they'll drop off my list. You know, I need to focus more on getting solid people on my contact list, people that are going to refer me and people that like to do business with me. So, you know, it's rare that I do that, but sometimes I do weed them out a bit like that.
So that's pretty sharp. You're actually culling your list. You're weeding your list down to the strongest referrers. That helps you focus on them and not be distracted by people who may not refer business to you.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, if I'm calling 10 people a week and I'm following up maybe with a personal card or a gift card or something just simple, quirky. If you think about it, I'm making, you know, 40 calls a week, which puts me at 480 calls, a little more than that, 480 calls a year, which I basically just called half my database over a year. You know, so, you know, when it comes down to after a year, what do? Chances are they're getting a call from me and they're getting a lot of other personal things from me. So, it's a way to kind of really keep gauge of what's going on in your database, because that is your foundation. That is your lifeline. You know, that is what's going to give you business, at least for my business.
Yeah, it sounds like in year two, they're receiving at least 6 pieces from you, the personal cards of Thanksgiving, Christmas, and then the magazine 4 times a year. Do you schedule calls on top of that? There's a certain number of calls you try to make each year to each of these folks?
If I don't talk to them during the year from a referral or thanking them for something, or they don't call me for randomly sending them a gift card or thanking them, then the only time I will talk to them is if they're on my list of 10 people to call that week. You know, so if I have 800 people in my database, I'm calling 480 people a year. I'm talking to them for the most part every year and a half, you know. And keep in mind that some of the people that I call, say I call 480 people in a year, if I don't have the referrals to let me give away $500 worth of gift cards, I'm giving away those gift cards no matter what. So I'll pick people from my database that I had a great transaction with, I had an okay transaction with, that maybe I just want to reach out to. I'll send them a quick note, send them a gift card. And guess what? 90% of the time, they'll call you and say, hey, thanks. Can't believe you sent that to me. You know, what did I do for this? And I say, hey, nothing. You know, I just thought about you the other day, and then I figured that you'd enjoy going to the movies, or I figured that you'd enjoy the $25 gift card, or I figured you'd like coffee or iTunes $10 gift card, you know, just depending on what they have or who they are, I'm constantly in and out of that database.
And do you keep track of what you send them? Do you write that down in your database?
Yeah, I have in the notes section a section that says when I sent them, what I sent them, and whatnot. Yeah, I do.
How do you decide who you're going to make those unique calls to for instance, the tickets? Do you have a certain method that you use there?
I like sports, you know, so I'm very personable whenever I'm finding homes. So you spend a lot of time with people when you're selling a house or whatnot. You tend to call and talk to people a lot. So, you know, some of our conversations are not just business. Sometimes it's personal stuff. So I kind of drop hints to see whether they're fanatics or not. And if so, I'm really excited to put them in my notes because I just love giving away things to them. You know, I love saying, hey, you want to go to Giants game in a week? You know, so I indirectly kind of ask them.
How many tickets do you have? Do you have 2 season tickets, 4? Do you try to buy a block of 20?
No, I have 2 seats, lower box. So I'm calling, and I divide them up with a business partner. So, you know, if I have 42 tickets, it's 42 calls I can make and 42 things I could give away in a season. I don't give them all away. Sometimes if I know a client's a true fanatic, and if the client's a fanatic and I know that they've done well and they've referred a ton of business to me, I'll go to the game with them, you know, so it gives me an excuse to get away for a little bit. So, you know, usually I could give away anywhere from, you know, 30 to 40 tickets a year.
Yeah, that was my other question, whether you are offering to give 1 ticket away and they go with you, or you give them 2 tickets and they bring somebody else.
Depending. Most of them, they go with somebody else. I like them to take the wife or the kid or something, and you know, but every once in a while when I know that it's somebody that is a fanatic and they know that I'm a fanatic, then we'll go out there together, and it gives us that half a day we're going to spend to really bond, you know, and grow our relationship, you know, get to know them a little more personally. And a lot of them are business contacts. I love doing that with business contacts. I have a client that's a CFO of a large firm here, and you know, I spend a lot of time with him talking sports, doing things like that. But, you know, in the last year, he's excited to know me. He's excited to see me grow. I'm excited to know him. I'm excited to see him grow. And if I've told you he's referred 10 different transactions in the last 12 months, it's not enough. You know, he always does something. And I always enjoy hanging out with him. So, for instance, you know, that kind of client, you know, I'll go with him to the game and we'll hang out, talk.
Do you contact your database through email?
No, not really. I see email. I hate how much junk I have to read on my email. I think it's very passive. So I don't send like a news blast or anything like that. I do contact clients a lot, which is kind of, right now it's the way it's intertwined with email is Facebook. I have a good portion of my clients on Facebook. I would say out of my database, maybe 150 clients are friends of mine on Facebook. You know, hopefully that number grows. So that sometimes I respond in an email, but it goes directly into the Facebook system. So sometimes I do, but it's mostly through the Facebook messages or their wall or whatever.
Are you using any other type of social medium? You said you're using Facebook to stay in touch with your database. Anything else you're doing online?
Yeah, we're on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Trulia, things like that. But what I really use to keep in touch with my clients for the most part is Facebook.
It sounds like you prefer direct mail and phone calls.
I do, but you know what? With Facebook, you know, we're 3 years into Facebook, and sometimes I don't send out that personal card because I sometimes talk to clients online, like monthly, you know, when they're doing something, or they'll go back and forth on my post, which I think we have a pretty good relationship doing that. So I'll tailor that to them. So I won't send them a personal card or anything like that, or you know, but sometimes if I see that they love the dish at BJ's, then I'll make a note of that. I'll remember that, and then I'll surprise them with a little BJ gift card or something like that. So on some of those clients that I'm interacting with more frequently on Facebook, even though it's a little more of a passive interaction, I tailor them a little more on my database. So I don't, they still get my cards, they still get my magazine, they still get, you know, every once in a while they'll get that personal phone call. But if we're talking on a monthly basis, then, you know, I don't, I mean, I think our relationship is good enough, you know.
Do you have followers on Twitter?
I do. I don't have a large amount of followers on Twitter. I started using Twitter more for a custom website I did for a listing, and I just wanted to market it a bit more. I have a funny story on Twitter. I don't know if you want to use this, but I was reading somewhere that Bank of America was keeping track of their name on Twitter. So we're working on a short sale, and the problems usually come to me when they're the last minute problems to find a solution. And this client's foreclosure date was coming up in a week, and we had an accepted offer, we had an appraisal done by Bank of America. I mean, we had everything, but we just need to get somebody on the phone to extend this gentleman's foreclosure date. We couldn't get anybody on the phone, Bank of America, that wanted to help us. So a part of just talking to other agents all over the United States and sharing information, I heard that if you posted something on Twitter and tagged Bank of America, you'd usually get a response back. So I did that, and I'm not lying to you, maybe a minute and a half later, I got a call from the customer service department, and they fixed my problem within 3 hours. So, you know, some of the stuff I use them just to kind of help my clients out in any which way. It's bizarre to say that, but it worked. And the gentleman got another 45 days. We're going to close the shorts on about a week. Kept them out of foreclosure, you know.
Have you used that technique since?
You know what? That was the first time I used it. And, you know, it worked. It was fantastic. Bank of America is doing a great thing. And, you know, I had 2-3 people on the phone from B of A within 24 hours, and they fixed the problem in a heartbeat. And I got a follow-up call to see how I felt, you know. So it was really good.
What happens when you get the referral? What do you do when you receive the referral? What happens from there?
What happens from there is I'll instantly call the referral to set up an appointment to meet with them. Instantly also just send out a thank you card to the person that referred them to me. And whether it's a buyer or a seller, if it's a buyer, chances are they're not qualified. They don't really know the market. So I'll try to get them in my office to do our 30 to 45 minute introduction kind of talk to see what they really want to do. And then from there, we'll set them up with a follow-up appointment to a lender or whatever it may be. And they'll go into my Microsoft Outlook system, which I'll put notes in who the referral came from and what our initial conversation was like, what they're looking for, what their wants, their needs are. You know, if it's a seller, then I'll make contact with them, and for that, we'll set up an instant time to meet at their home, or if it's a listing presentation, we'll get information from them on the phone, and then we'll go over there and give them the listing presentation.
And the referrer gets a thank you card. Do you ever make a personal phone call to the referrer?
Yeah, I'll make the phone call, and in most cases, I'll make the phone call after, and then I'll send out a thank you card.
Okay, so you're doing both. To the person who referred the buyer or seller, you're calling the referrer and sending them a thank you card with a gift card inside?
Yeah, not all the times. I would say about 65% of the time they're getting a call and a card, depending on how my schedule is.
Do you send the referrer anything else after that, for instance, when the buyer or seller that they referred closes?
Yes.
So you'll send them a second card?
We won't send them a card. We'll just send them a thank you note. We want to give back while the iron's hot. You know, if somebody's referring somebody to us and they're a giver, you know, they'll be surprised when they receive.
You'll be doing it at least twice.
Yeah.
Once when they refer and once when the deal closes.
Mm-hmm.
What other ways are you generating business? You mentioned REO earlier. How is that working? How did you get into the REO business?
Well, that was something that we started 3 years ago. And My business partner, Joseph Bondi, which is a seasoned agent. He's been in the business for 28 years. He was actually a mentor. He still is a mentor to me in the way he does business and his just financial structure. I love it. And he was doing Bank of America REOs years back, and you know he's getting a little overwhelmed. So you know, I helped him out a bit when he went on a vacation, and he liked the way I handled the business. And I gave him a proposition. I was like, hey, you know, what are your thoughts of me using your resume or getting a hold of your contacts and maybe duplicating a couple of these accounts that you have? And he was open to it. We agreed to split everything down the middle, making it really, really simple. And, you know, we landed a couple accounts, which, you know, now that the market is transitioning a little bit, our inventory isn't that large on REO transactions. You know, if we close, you know, 20% of our business being REO, it's fine. But that's how I got into the REO business, is through his connection.
Who works the business when it comes in? Do you split that? Do you go every other person? How do you split this business up?
That's his basically baby. He takes care of you know, putting the checklist in place, making the folders for the property. We have checklists for everything. So we have a checklist when an REO comes in, you know, or when a short sale comes in, or when a buyer comes in. And, you know, he'll put that together and he'll start making contacts. And he's basically the field guy. He doesn't work with buyers. You know, he wants to work the 40 hours a week. He doesn't have it in him to work like, you know, the 60, 70 hour weeks like I do. But that's what he likes to do. So he handles most of that. When it comes down to negotiating or you know, talking to agents that bring offers to the table, my assistant takes care of a lot of that, or I do as well. I have a lot of clients in this market, considering that even agents that I do business with are quote unquote clients, because they tend to facilitate things for me because they have that personal relationship with my staff and know that we have a track record of managing our transactions correctly. So I tend to micromanage a bit more our communication when it comes down to talking to other agents when we're negotiating offers, just to build that relationship with them as well. So that's usually how we manage that business. On the REO business, it's not a large amount of business. He handles a lot of that. We have a staff member that we pay on an hourly basis. She's only part-time, and she takes care of all the accounting when it comes down to paying invoices and getting reimbursed from banks and the whole process of that. So that way neither him or I have to really deal with that. She also manages a lot of our rental property that we hold ourselves. You know, with him being a mentor to me and, you know, taking care of the REO business, we also do a lot of joint ventures when it comes down to owning real estate ourselves jointly. So we throw things off each other and we invest together, and we share her when it comes down to paying bills on rentals or paying handymen on repairs on our rentals, collecting rents, and accounting for that.
Okay, so you're splitting the cost of the accountant to the bookkeeper between you and your partner on the REO side.
Yeah.
How about short sales? You said you're doing some short sales. How are you generating that business? How's that working out?
We do a lot of referral on that too, and on that, believe it or not, we get a lot of cold leads on that. Which we don't take them too lightly. We actually, when somebody's calling us about a short sale, we instantly switch our mode to not a cold lead but a warm lead, because they're actually reaching out to us and they need help, you know. So we don't we're very, very receptive to them. So I have a real estate blog, which I blog on. I've kind of neglected it in the last month or two because it's been extremely busy. But, and I also have a blog on Trulia, where I put a lot of things up about short sales. Not just the typical market snapshot that you see a lot out there, but like really relevant information, like case scenario. This is a short sale we got. This is who the bank was. Keep everything confidential. But we break down what the process was from opening to close, from gathering information to making contacts with the banks to listing to selling to getting a short sale approval to closing escrow. And they put the time frame on it. and I put obstacles that we had to overcome, or sometimes they're very, very easy. So if you're a seller and you have a short sale and you don't know what's going to happen, what to expect, usually you could go on that website or my blog and get at least 4 or 5 case scenarios saying, oh, I have Bank of America, I have Wells Fargo, this is what I should expect, this is what they're going to do. And in that point, we do get a lot of our short sale leads from online sources or just word of mouth where people say, hey, you need to go on this website, take a look at what can happen, actually, like true case scenarios, and then it generates calls to us.
How many case scenarios do you have?
I believe right now I have 5 or 6 of them on there.
And they're all with different banks?
All with different banks, yeah.
That was pretty smart.
And we also do that with buyers. I mean, I have different sections on my blog which has buyers, and we used to more aggressively before market from start to finish, from the time we sat down with the referral buyer or to the day we handed them their keys. It's a very competitive market. Buyers are scared. Buyers don't know how long it's going to take them to buy a house. You know, you're competing with a lot of investors. They get frustrated. Lending is very, very difficult. And I put those stories on my website. So, for instance, our generation is very information-based. They want instant information right away. You know, somebody might tell you something, but, you know, reading it is completely different. And when you go on a website and say, well, I'm going to look in Modesto or in Manteca or in Turlock for a certain price range, and you see all these stories from people that purchased homes in the same situation that you're in, and you see how long it took them, how many offers they submitted, you know, how the escrow process was, what kind of issues they came across, what their payment is, what their interest rate was, you know, and who their lender was, it makes you feel a little more comfortable when you're talking to an agent, because you kind of know what to expect. So we kind of take the stance as people are tired of being sold to, so if you educate them, eventually when they're ready, they'll come to you.
Tell me about Central Valley Investments Golden Streets. What was that?
Well, what it is you know, we've had a lot of negative publicity in the Central Valley. I mean, we were number 1 and 2 in the list of foreclosure cities for the last 2 years, you know, named the worst place to live. You know, I mean, there's a lot of devastation when it comes down to unemployment. But, you know, you could either look at the glass half full and see pavement on the streets, or look at the streets and see gold. You know, you're seeing the street and you're seeing low prices, low interest rates, buyers that are improving their lifestyle by buying a house, actually reducing their monthly expenses. Investors that are buying properties and getting 10, 15, 20, 25% a year. That's very exciting, you know. It's funny to say that, you know, we're the most devastated city when it comes to home prices or unemployment, and one of the top ones in the nation, but at the same time get published in Zillow saying that we're the number 2 city in the nation, best place to invest, you know. So you're either going to look at the negative news and get influenced by the negative news as an agent and be affected by it, or you're going to look at the silver lining, the gold on the streets, and you're going to say, look, I could make this happen. There is opportunity out there. There's buyers out there. You know, you either put the effort in and you look at the glass half full, or you're looking at the negative stuff, and, you know, you're not motivating yourself to come to work.
How much of your business are investor buyers?
Investor buyers, I would say, that's a question. It's hard to put that down. It's about 30, 35% or so, I would say.
These are either past clients or referrals from past clients, or are you going out to target those folks a different way?
The referrals, in most cases, referrals. Sometimes we get leads, which my brother deals with, from out-of-town investors that actually typed in, say, Central Valley or Modesto rental property, and then one of our blog posts comes up on an investor we closed escrow on and showing what they did, how long it took them, how much money they put down, what their payment was, what their rate on return was, and then they'll call us saying, hey, I like that return. How can I do that? And then it kind of goes from there.
So you have investor scenarios on your blog as well.
Yeah, we have all types of selling scenarios. We have 1031 exchange scenarios, if you're doing that. Things that we've done, you know, the upgrade buyer, the downgrade buyer, moving out of state seller that turns into a buyer, or, you know, out of state, like contingent or concurrent closings. We have first-time buyers, investor buyers, and short sellers. So if we're if we do 200 transactions a year, guess what? We probably have a lot of experience, and it's good to share that and educate people on the experiences that we see on a daily basis. You know, because things are changing all the time. People want to know. You know, like if you're buying a car, or this is something that I do. I buy a car or I buy a TV set, I tend to Google what the average price is. You know, what are people buying these cars for? What's the MSRP? What are they actually paying for this car? Because I want to know that I absolutely got the best deal. Or I want to know at least what to expect. So I know I feel comfortable whenever I'm going in there to buy a vehicle or buy a TV or buy whatever. And people do that with the largest investment they're going to make, which is a home. They'll Google the heck out of it. You know, they'll find you that way. You know, because you're putting information out there that's relevant, not just giving a 80-page packet to somebody. You know, you're actually giving them a case scenario. This is what it's going to be. Guess what? They're going to feel comfortable to pick up the phone.
So don't tell them, show them.
Don't tell them, show them. That's part of it. I mean, when I work with a buyer for the first time, before I even put a mile in my car, I find them the perfect house. And in my office, I have like three different monitors, and I have a 42-inch plasma on my wall. And we go through a virtual tour of the city. Instead of driving, let's get all that riffraff out of the way. I don't want to go out there and show you five homes that you're absolutely going to hate so I can start filtering it out. You know, let's find the perfect house right now. Let's find that perfect neighborhood. And I'm going to show you what the actives are, what the pendings are, and what the solds are. And I'm going to show you what the relevance is between the active purchase price and an actual close price, and if there's any concessions or anything. You know, so I'm educating them while they're here. So that 10, 15, 20-minute virtual tour that we do saves me a couple hours and a couple meetings of driving them out there, showing them things that are never going to interest them. You know, so we do it all here in the comfort of my office before we even set out on the streets.
What's the name of your blog?
It's a Blogspot blog. It's just the blogspot.danieldelreal.com.
You talked about 30% were investors. Are they buying single-family residence or are they buying multi-unit?
Both. What's hot right now is single-family. Right now, the median price of single-family is 120. You could cash flow with 20% down on that, 10, 15%, no problem. So a lot of what's selling right now is single-family.
How are you tracking your leads? You said you're using Outlook. So once a lead comes in and they become viable, they go in the Outlook?
Yeah, they go in my Outlook system.
Talk about your follow-up with that lead once they go into your Outlook system.
Usually if they go in my Outlook system, I have some notes there. We'll I talk to somebody and I set them up an appointment in a couple of days, then they'll go in that day's appointment. And every day I set up a follow-up appointment with them, whether it's showing homes or doing daily searches for them or just checking in with them on a daily basis. And I categorize them on my Outlook system by colors and by numbers. So, you know, blue being people that are pre-qualified, that are looking for homes, or, you know, green being listings that we have on the market. I put on a weekly follow-up call and go through comparables with them. But then once they end up where we're negotiating an offer, either a buyer or a seller, we put them in red. And as soon as they go into escrow, we put them in a fire orange. And as soon as they close, we'll put them in a yellow stance where, you know, they end up fading away after that and go into the other database. But I just categorize them like that. I have a checklist for sellers, whether it's short sell, REO, but I really don't have a checklist for buyers. I just have a system of doing things that it's just kind of automatic.
Let's talk about sellers. How many listings do you currently have?
I have 24 listings.
When you are going to go out to list a property, do you do a two-step or a one-step listing appointment? Do you try to get the listing the first time you go out, or do you just go look at the property first and try to get the listing on a second appointment?
I do a two-step. For the most part, I'm dealing a lot with short sales. So when somebody reaches out to you and tells you about their personal finances, they've probably done some research on you, and they have a pretty good idea that they're gonna list with you, especially when they're telling you personal information like finances. So I'm not going to pressure them into listing a property with me when it's such a very delicate situation. So I'll go there, go to their house, look at their property, and give them my short sale package. that like a checklist of what to expect or what you need, and then I'll give them a day or two, and then they'll usually call me back to set up a time to list their property for short sales. On the selling end, depending on the private party end, depending on the type of lead, sometimes I'm always ready with a listing appointment, a listing contract, always. But if I see it's a time to close it, then I do it. If not, then I rely heavily on my presentation and my experience and my track record to feel comfortable enough. If I go with another, if they talk to another agent, chances are they're not going to be as sharp or as experienced as I am when it comes down to it, or as on cutting edge of marketing stuff that I do. So usually when they, if they meet with somebody else, they'll just call me back and say, hey, list the house, you know. So that I do, for the most part, I do a two-step, but I'm always ready with the listing paperwork at our initial point.
How much time do you plan or schedule for each of those steps, the first step and the second?
30 to 45 minutes on initial, and on the sign-up, when we list the property, we do everything at once. So we sign all the disclosures up front, so that way we don't have to bother the seller, and we make our business more efficient, more automatic. We sign all contingency removals. So that takes a little longer. That takes about an hour to do. So our initial is about 30 to 45 minutes to talk and go over what we're about and what we could offer them. And the following one is about an hour to really go through all the disclosures and go through the listing appointment. Now, I do that sometimes. Sometimes it's my brother, or sometimes it's my assistant. She's licensed, so she could do it as well.
Where are those appointments taking place?
The initial appointment's at their house. The follow-up appointment's at my office.
Do you ever do any of these listings over the phone or over the internet?
Over the phone, we talk, but you can't really list a property over the phone. You can't give anybody an idea on value until you actually see the home.
That second step, you don't ever have to do that over the phone. You're going to do it in your office, or if they can't, you're going to meet them in person at their place.
Yeah, we'll meet them in person in their place. Or sometimes I do it over the phone. I have people that sell property that are out of town, and our initial will be there, and then they'll call me saying, hey, Daniel, we want to list. So we'll send everything via DocuSign and have them sign all our docs, and we'll be on the market the following day with everything else that needs to be done. You know, so it's case by case. I love using DocuSign every time I have a chance, but at the same time, I'm not going to handicap my personal relationship with somebody just because I want to simplify it.
Do you send out a pre-listing package?
No, I don't.
But you do bring an information package on a short sale. You said you have a short sale package?
Yeah, I have a short sale package and a listing presentation as well that I put together in the last couple of years.
Are you giving that listing presentation on your initial step, or are you waiting for the sign-up step?
No, initial step. That's when you're really going to sell yourself. So whether you're going to love you or hate you, they want to do business with you or not. So when you're going over there, to talk to them, look at their home, but at the same time, I go in there with an idea of value, depending if, like a big range, you know, that way I'm not committed to a price until I look at the home, but I show them comparables. I show them our marketing tools, what we have, what we're about, our track record, our performance, our mission statement, our company. And, you know, we'll go through all that, you know, within those 30, 45 minutes while we're there. So we really want to sell them while we're there because we want that second initial, we want that second appointment.
So you have a canned or a standard listing presentation that you use?
Yeah, I do.
Is that written down on paper, or do you have it on a computer? How do you display that to them?
It's on paper, but our marketing, like videos and stuff like that, you can't do that on paper. All you could show on paper is a flyer and that you could put a sign up, but you know, we're so past that. Selling a home by putting up a post and putting a cool flyer up is basically over. So we show them our videos. I go out there with an iPad or my Mac, and I show them some of the examples of some of the actual videos that we do on some of these properties.
What do you mean by a video of the property? What kind of marketing are you doing there?
Well, that's the cool thing is, you know, we do virtual tours like a lot of agents do. We found a really cool website called Tour Factory that does some really cool tours, you know, which is great. We use that as well, but We actually hire a photographer, videographer to go through these listings and actually video these properties, like walking in them and showing, you know, kind of real life a walkthrough on this property. And we do some of that stuff, and we have sometimes personal websites on a couple listings, or depending on the neighborhood, we'll have a website just for that neighborhood as specialists with a few videos and a couple properties that are listed in that neighborhood that we have. So it's just kind of like a real, but you could see some of these videos if you like. I have, for instance, there's this community in Modesto where they're the most exquisite homes you see. We actually just sold one of those properties for $1.625 million, which was the highest sell in Modesto year to date. So we have a website that, if you go to that, that shows you what listings we have in that community. They're all higher-end properties. DiscoverRiver9.com. If you go on that website, you'll see these custom videos that are just phenomenal. And I credit that website for that $1.625 million sale, because the gal that saw those homes, that home, saw it over a year ago at an open house, and wasn't ready to purchase because she needed to get some financing straight with the stock market and doing things like that and actually get the funds. But she kept going back to that video, she told me, and she'd play it like once a week. She loved it. She loved the house. She just wanted, it was right on the golf course. Beautiful, beautiful design. And once she got her funds, she convinced her husband, and she kept this experience in her mind because we kept putting her in that house every time she went to our website. They bought that house a year after they saw it. You know, sight unseen, basically, as she hadn't seen it for a year. She called us and wanted to make an offer without even seeing it. We didn't show it to her again after we were in contract.
She went direct to you. She didn't grab a buyer agent. She went direct to you as the lister.
She came direct to me, yeah.
You mentioned that you have a video photographer.
Uh-huh.
How much does something like that cost to get one of these set up?
It cost me about $350 to make that video, about $350.
What a great investment.
Oh, fantastic investment. And not only that, but I mean, nobody else is doing that. Nobody is spending that kind of money on advertising people's homes, really. Sometimes they are, but it's something that if somebody's selling, I'm sorry, but if I had a house that, say, it was $130,000 or $1 million, I'm proud of that house when I'm selling it. I'm more proud of the house, and that's the thing that we're seeing with sellers is, you know, it's usually us bringing them down to earth, you know, saying, okay, no, this is the true value of the house. But when they see the effort that you put into their house and really, you know, amplifying the uniqueness on their properties by doing something like this and spending your money on it, then they tend to stick with you, whether you have the listing for 45 days or a year. They want to keep renewing that listing because they know that you're doing everything possible to get that property sold, and nobody else is going to do anything like that. So we do have that bit of uniqueness, too.
In the video itself, it's a video of them walking through the home. Is somebody talking over that? Is there music playing over it?
There's music and subtitles down at the bottom as you're walking into the rooms. I'm trying to... It's something I'm going to change. I'm going to start putting myself a bit more in the videos just to kind of throw me out there a little bit. But it's something that I've been kind of camera shy to do. But it does point out that we're the point of contact on the video.
Do you have a picture of yourself on that video?
No, it has our logo, the Del Rio Group. For the most part, that's usually what we put out there.
How long is the clip? Is it 30 seconds, a minute?
2.5 minutes to walk through the house. It starts from the street, looking at the street view, and it goes through the entrance, and it goes throughout.
Do you do that on all your listings?
Most of them. We're in an interesting market, so short sale listings, they're a little more private. Maybe they don't want as many photos as much as we do on them. Some of the REO properties that we have, of course, we'll do the simple virtual tour on them. But for the private sellers, we really do go above and beyond to do that.
Any other items you think you're doing that are unique in finding a buyer for one of your listings?
We market some of the photographer and the pictures that we take of it, the video tour. We syndicate that video into Facebook, Zillow, Trulia, Homes.com, YouTube, and we just try to attract as much activity to it.
I assume you're doing some type of follow-up feedback to your sellers as you're moving along the listing process. How often are you doing that, and who's making the contact?
Doing it once a week, and we'll do it two different ways, depending on how the seller is. We'll either, that's when it comes down a little more to email. We'll send them a weekly snapshot of the price reductions, the pendings, the sold in their neighborhood. And I'll either mail it to them if they're the mail type, or I'll email it to them if they're the email type. And either myself or my assistant will follow it up with a phone call.
Who negotiates the offer that comes in? Is it you or your assistant?
I do, with her help too. I mean, I call the seller direct, but she sometimes talks to the other agent to make sure that we have everything we need with their pre-approval letter, that we verify that they are approved by calling the lenders, proof of funds, deposits, make sure the offer is solid before we even put it in front of our seller.
Who is negotiating the inspection?
Then she's doing all that.
Your assistant?
Yeah, she's setting it all up. You know, when we do get a repair request or something like that, she'll take care of that.
Who's attending the closing?
Myself, for the most part, or either my brother Enrique, if it's a buyer. For the most part, it's me going to some of these closings.
Do you do anything special at the closing? Do you have a gift, anything that's unique other than just closing?
Yeah, when we sell a property, we don't do anything unique, but when we actually help a buyer purchase a home and we close it, depending on who it is, if it's an investor, they just want action. You know, give me bids to get it painted, carpet, you know, get me hooked up with a property manager. And so we help them by performing. On a buyer, they're more personal. So we'll go over there and we'll wrap the door with a bow, and we'll have them pick up the keys from our office and take that nice drive back to their place. And usually it comes, and they'll see the bow on their door with a little note saying, welcome home. And put a little tiny note in there. And, you know, that's what we do. And then we'll send them within a week, we'll send them that congratulations card with a nice confetti so they could clean up.
Let's talk about buyers. How many buyers are you currently working with?
I like to work with, if I'm not working with 10 to 15 buyers at any given time, then I'm doing something wrong. I usually tend to base my business on the buyers that I'm working with, not the escrows that I have. And I tell my brother that too, because he, you know, we like to keep ourselves pretty busy with buyers or sellers. So in cases, if I know if I'm working with, say, 10 to 15 buyers at any given time, which is why I'm very selective with the clients that I work with. Because if I'm working with 15 solid referral buyers, I am not going to take on that 16th one and neglect the other ones. You know, I can't. I know that I can handle, you know, I would say 15 stretching it, but 10 to 15 buyers. If I know I do that, I know that I'm writing, 10 to 15 offers a week, which I know that I at least have, you know, 8 to 12 escrows on buyers at a given time. So I try to focus on how active I am with my buyer leads, are the buyers that I'm actually looking for, which then I know trickles into, you know, escrows that I have. You know.
Talk about your first conversation with the buyer. What kind of questions are you asking? What's your objective?
Well, I'm asking what basically their wants and needs. You know, I want to establish that first, a budget. So I don't want to send them to a lender and get them approved for $200,000 when they're comfortable with $130,000. You know, so we'll go through their budget, and I kind of have an idea. If they say they're comfortable with $1,000 a month, I know that they're going to be purchasing, or they're comfortable purchasing for $130,000, $135,000. So I'm not going to show them homes on the internet for $200,000. You know, so I first talk about their budget and what caused them to look for a house, and start talking to them about what they're looking for, what neighborhoods they're looking at. And I'll give them a little virtual tour of the city in my office.
When do you bring the lender in?
I don't bring the lender in until I get them in my office. So my initial conversation with them, it's probably like a minute and a half. And it's just saying, hey, how you doing? Returning your phone call, or so-and-so referred me to you. And then just set up that appointment. I want to get in front of them instantly, you know? And then I'll set up the time so they could come in. At that point, then I'll start letting them talk about what they want, what they need, what they think they're gonna get, or what they've heard.
And so you do that at your office, that appointment?
Yes.
And everybody has to go through that appointment before you'll take them out to look at homes?
Yes.
Do you take people out to look at homes right after that appointment?
No. After that appointment, I identify a budget, I identify what they're looking at, and I will set up a follow-up appointment on the spot with one of my lenders, usually 24 to 48 hours after we met. So I'll pick up the phone and end up letting the lender know, setting up an appointment with them, and then I'll shoot the lender an email saying, this is their budget, this is what they're looking for, keep this in mind when you're getting them approved. That way he's not sending me an approval for, 30, 40, 50% over what they're comfortable with. So, and he knows where his conversation is going to lay, if it's going to be in the medium price range, or if it's going to be in a higher price range, if they're coming in with money down. I usually try to feed that to them, which I usually get on the first initial meeting. I feel that the buyers want to meet you and also let you know what they want and need, and for them to know that you care what they want and need, and that you're actually thinking about the finances before you ship them off to a lender.
So do you ask financial questions?
Yeah, when our initial appointment, a lot of financial questions. We go through their budget, and I do it in a way where, I'm not just saying, where are you comfortable at? I softly ask, what are you paying for rent? Have you gone through your budget? What do you, how do you see yourself? What kind of payment do you see yourself being able to handle? And then I kind of just unravel it like that.
How long is that initial appointment?
That could be, most part, about 30 minutes, 30 to 45 minutes.
Is it in that initial appointment that you show them properties and you give them that virtual tour, or is that later?
No, I'll do it on that appointment, just to kind of give them a quick idea. I want to gather as much information on that appointment. So whenever the second appointment happens with the lender and they call me saying they're excited they got approved, or I call them saying, hey, congratulations, you've been approved, my next appointment with them is to show them homes. And usually if they're tech savvy, we'll set them up with a search online so they could start looking at some of these homes, and we'll go back and forth, develop a list, and then we'll start heading out there and looking at homes.
Are you signing up buyers on a buyer agency agreement?
No, we don't sign them up. We can, but we don't.
So that's not occurring in that first interaction, that first meeting?
No, we don't tie them into any kind of contract. Usually when they're a referral, they tend to want to work with us, especially after that first appointment. So I'm the first one to say, if we're not working well together, then we'll know it instantly, and I'll be the first one to say it.
So you do have a loyalty pledge then, some type of statement that you just made, where you're trying to gain their trust or loyalty to you rather than going and working with another agent.
Yeah, and it goes back to educating them, letting them know, hey, look, your representation is free. The seller's going to pay for that. So do you want to work with somebody exclusively? Our search might take a week, might take a month, might take 6 months, might take a year. Where I'm not there to sell you every house you see. I'm there to help you find the house, and as soon as you fall in love with it, I'll help you negotiate it and get that house and be protected through it. So that's a stance that I take with them, where, if you don't work exclusively with me and you're calling every listing agent on their sign call, guess what? They're not going to have a rapport with you. They're going to try to sell you on every single house, because the chances are that after that appointment, they're not going to see you again. So do you want those awkward conversations? Do you want those awkward financial questions that people are going to ask? Or do you want to build that relationship with me, develop a plan, and work your plan, whether it takes a week, whether it's one offer submitted, whether it's 10 offers submitted, whether it takes 6 months? We're here to ride that out with you. And everybody's a bit different. Usually when I tell them that, it puts them at ease, and they say, okay, I found my spot. I know where I'm going to be.
Who's actually doing the showings, you or your assistant?
Myself or my brother, which is a buyer's agent. We're constantly out there showing homes. I assist setting up appointments when I give her a list of, 5-6 homes, and, or say 15 homes with 3 different buyers of tours I'm going to do or my brother's going to do at the end of the day, and she calls them and checks to see if availability of them, offer status, or a situation with it.
What percentage of the buyers do you think you're showing versus your buyer agent?
Well, see, he has his own group of buyers, and, I have my group of buyers. I think with, for instance, the 200 transactions that I closed, of those, I would say maybe 80 of those buyers were my closings that I work with directly showing homes. And he assisted me with some of them, when I wasn't available, I was tied up. And then from him, he'd probably do about 40, and he'll do half about what I do. So together we do about 120. So if you do the math on that, I do most the showings, and he does a third of them. Whatever cold lead we have, he kind of sees if he could develop it into a long-term relationship. But that's one thing that I'm lacking, is I don't delegate that well. I like to be hands-on because I love what I do. I love going out there showing homes. I love talking to people. And I know it's a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of effort, and maybe I'm working a little more in real estate than on real estate, but it's just, I just love it. I like doing it. So it's very tough for me to let that go and have an agent work with my client, you know, throughout the whole process without me being involved. I really like being in the trenches working.
Who's negotiating these buyer transactions? Is that you or somebody else on the team?
We'll write the offer up, and then my assistant goes to and she starts submitting those offers to the agents, getting me responses. As soon as we have responses, then she'll call the buyer or I'll call the buyer. It'll be a mutual thing. We work together.
Do you attend the closings for the buyers?
I attend about 50 to 60% of the closings, depending on my schedule. I don't attend all of them. My assistant does attend a few of them, but I try to attend depending on the client and how hands-on they want me to be. You know, I'll attend about 50% of the closings.
You've mentioned a lot about the team. Let's talk about your team right now. Let's talk about who you have on the team, what positions they are, and what they do for you, their titles and responsibilities. So let's start with your first assistant. Does she have a specific title, and what are her responsibilities?
She's a coordinator, but we name her contract manager. So anytime we put anything in contract or we're negotiating a contract, she takes care of it after that. So the only time she lets me know anything on that is just to give me an update of what's going on with, like, inspections. But if we have a problem, then I tend to handle that. But she lets me focus on generating business and working with active buyers or sellers that we have now. My buyer's agent, my brother, which is part of the Del Rio Group, he deals a lot with the buyers that get assigned to him, and he also helps me out a bit with some of my buyers if I'm tied up on some showings. He also has a slash next to him because he helps me with putting a lot of the marketing material together when it comes down to our private listings and our short sales. So that's his job. And then my REO listing partner, which is my business partner too, I'm Joseph Bondi. He deals a lot with the REO side of it, with those properties. And that's what he manages. He runs around and takes pictures, makes sure our utilities are on, makes sure everything is going fine on that end. And we have, of course, a gal that we also pay an hourly salary to that handles our invoicing when it comes down to our personal expenses with our own real estate or the listings that we have.
Bookkeeper is part-time?
Yeah, she's part-time.
And everybody else is full-time?
Mm-hmm.
Contract manager, buyer, agent, and partner, they're all licensed?
All of them are licensed. My assistant, the contract manager, she's on a salary. She's on a salary there, and every once in a while we'll throw a bonus on certain closings that just need to close on a certain time. And the buyer's agent, my brother, he's on commission, so everything he closes, I have him on a split on that. Whether I worked with the lead at all or not, whether it came in on sign or whether it came in on an advertising, I usually have a split for him at that. And then my REO listing partner, we just divide everything evenly. And that's how I usually keep myself so well-balanced when you look at my numbers, you know. I have 120 buyer transactions and 80 selling transactions. It's usually because I have it well spread and I have the people to help.
You've talked a little bit about technology and how you use it in your business. Is there any technology that we didn't talk about?
I think we covered some of it. I mean, the vital things for us is we use Dropbox a lot. We love it. All our files, all our closings are put in Dropbox. All our buyers, every time we do an offer, everything is digital. So we put it in Dropbox with their name and their file. The Dropbox, I don't know a lot of people know, but if you have an iPhone or iPad, you can access those documents anywhere you are. Anywhere. The same thing with another thing is LogMeIn. You know, I have a computer for my database. I have a computer that I run my day-to-day operations with. My assistant has a computer. My buyer's agent, my brother, has a computer. We have a computer set up on the big 42-inch screen in my office, and my business partner has a computer. And we're all tied in through LogMeIn. We all have access to every single one of our computers at any time through that LogMeIn software, and it works fantastic. You know, if I'm at home and I want to check something on my database, then I go through LogMeIn and I log into the computer. If I want to check to something in my assistant's desk, and I do that, or she could do the same, or I want to check my own personal computer, I could do that, my brother's computer, my REO business partner's computer, or, you know, I could do it all through LogMeIn no matter where we're at. So it frees us from the office and it lets us do business wherever we are.
It's a virtual network.
Yeah, it's basically a network between our team.
Daniel, you have a lot of people running around doing a lot of things. Are you profitable?
Yeah, we are, and I kept it small because of that. You know, I was always afraid of that getting too big and you know, end up being that the CEO of the company ends up making less than the employees, and I didn't structure it that way. I have fixed expenses with my assistant, which she's worth every dime. You know, as soon as I hired her, my business absolutely took off. When I started delegating, I was surprised. You know, I had more time to generate business. With my brother Enrique, he's accountable for his own income. He actually brings value to my business. He never takes anything away. So business that I wouldn't really handle because I'm so active with a lot of my referrals, business that would usually not, I would usually not attend to, it goes attended with him. And he has a track record. He closed 40 buyer transactions last year. Business I would have never had. So it helps me, never takes anything away from me. My REO business partner, we split all the REO business. Business I wouldn't have time to attend, you know. And like I said, he brings business to me. It doesn't take any. So everything, everybody on my staff adds value, helps us all make more money, never takes anything away. So every time I'm very selective. That's why I bring a lot of family into, like, my brother is my buyer's agent, my REO listing partner, he was my mentor for years. We do a lot of joint ventures together, very close to my heart, to my family. My assistant, same thing. Her mom is my child's babysitter. You know, I keep them really close because I want us all to grow together. And usually they bring value to me, and I hopefully give them a little value back.
So that people can gauge what they should expect as they're trying to grow their businesses, would you mind disclosing what your profit margin is as a percentage of gross revenue?
If I spend 30% of what I make on generating new business for my staff, that would be a lot. So about 30% of my, if I spend, you know, $3,000 to make 10, that's usually what I'm doing. Anywhere from 20 to 30% of what I make goes out in administration fees or advertising direct to my contacts or whatever other expenses I have.
Because you're so active in your business, your profit margin, it sounds like, is somewhere between 70 and 80%.
Yeah. And I could drop that if I wanted to take more time off. But, you know, I'm 8 years in the business. I'm 30 years old. I don't have the time for that right now. I need to make some money. I need to pay taxes. We need to get our country back. We can't take the back seat. We need to put the shoe leather on the ground, go out there, work, and, you know, reap the rewards. And yeah, maybe I could do more business if I brought somebody else on staff, but, you know, I'm more hands-on. I enjoy what I do. It's my career. You know, I love every minute of it. So, you know, I surround myself with good people that benefit my business, and it's been working well. You know, there hasn't been a year in the last 4 years that I've closed less than 150 transactions, and I'm happy with that. And a lot of happy home buyers, a lot of great relationships. It's a good business to be into, but, you know, you need to put some work into it. I was working 7 days a week for 6 years until my son was born. He's 19 months now. I just started taking Sundays. Thank you. I just started taking Sundays off. So, you know, I love it. And one of the biggest things I tell my staff is, you know, say, look, if you're going to be at work, be at work. If you're going to be at home, be at home. You know, I could be at home 1 day a week and 2 hours a night, but I'm present 100% of the time. You know, I shut my phone off. I am done until the next morning. And I think I'm more valuable like that than to be home, you know, 3 days a week and be present 50 to 30% of the time because I'm answering phone calls or I'm worrying about other things. So, you know, one of the biggest things is saying be present, whether it's your family life or your business life. You know, I know agents that are in the office for 8 hours a week and they sit here and they do nothing. You know, they're worrying about home when they're at work, and they're worrying about work when they're at home. So the only thing that the biggest advice I tell people is saying, hey, if you're going to be at work, be at work. Be present 100% of the time. Surround yourself with great people. If you're going to be at home 100% of the time and close everything off.
How many hours do you work in a typical week?
It's a lot. My days usually run 10 to 13 hours. My Saturdays tend to be, you know, 6 to 10 hours, and my Sundays are free. So, you know, if you do the math, I'm working at least 60 hours a week, which is not bad. I mean, I was in the military. I was used to working 24 hours a day. They used to tell me that you don't have days off. You have days that the military says you don't wear that uniform. So it was during September 11th, so guess what? You know, working 13 hours a day for me was a break. I'm really blessed and fortunate that that happened because it taught me how to work hard and, you know, how to take a break and work 13 hours.
Daniel, do you have a business plan?
I do.
How often do you review it?
I have it in front of me every day. Every time I open up my planner, it's right there.
Do you modify it as you go through the year?
Yeah, I do. I'm aggressive with my business plan, but it's bizarre. We always find a way to meet it or beat it. So I end up having to change things and increasing some numbers that I see that, you know, we need to increase. So yeah, I modify it. I probably touch it maybe once a month.
Are there certain numbers that you like to track in your business?
You know, just referrals. I'm not a big like tracker. I just know that if the phones are ringing, it's working. You know, and I have the systems in place to make it all automatic, so I don't have to keep analyzing it. If it's working, it's working. I could tweak, but other than that, the system is going fine. So I'm not going to spend, you know, hours a day analyzing something that's already working. You know, if it's not working, I'll know. And guess what? At that point, I'll start looking at it. But to answer your question, I do track where the leads come from, but I don't have a system that says exactly, you know, or I don't put them into a system where I track exactly where they're at every given moment. But I just, you know, as long as pipeline is full, I'm doing something right, and I'm making calls. And, you know, I say that when my iPhone doesn't register by the end of the day, if it doesn't register my 10 o'clock calls, that means I had a great day. So if my iPhone says, if I looked all the way down to the bottom, which I think takes 100 and something numbers a day, if I can't see the calls I made at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, then I had a great day.
Do you have any affiliate businesses, mortgage, title, things like that?
Nothing really like insurance business or nothing like that. The only thing we do have that is, and this is probably something that would be good for an agent to know, is I have a business that focuses on my exit strategy. You know, that's the biggest mistake I see agents do. They make money year in, year out, but they never have an exit strategy. Even though you love your career, which I love my career, but guess what? I love my career because it secures my financial future. And I see that in 10, 15 years, I'm probably going to be able to sell my database to somebody for a good amount of money, so I structure it that way. Just like any other business, you treat it like a business, but at the same time, you have an exit strategy. So my other company that I have is a corporation where I buy and hold real estate, which gives me passive income. And I also, we do a lot of buy and flips. So we also have a lot of, you know, it's just a whole different beast when it comes down to who we have on staff that are contractors or, you know, the project managers or lenders on that end. And that's just mostly to secure our financial future. So the stuff that I tell my clients when they're investing in real estate, I don't tell them, I don't educate them, I show them. You know, it's not weird for me to show a buyer, an investor, a new investor, what my purchases were and what kind of returns I make. And I show them. I show them my vacancy rate. I show them what I spend on some of these repairs. And, you know, and it works well for me. It's like when I went out and looked for a financial advisor, I wanted to see what he invested his money in. If we work well together and he's investing his money into it, guess what? I'm going to do the same thing, you know, if we have the same personality. So I have an affiliated business, but it's my exit strategy. It's my investing in myself and my retirement.
How many flips do you think you're doing in a year?
You know, this year we're set to do 20. I think we're working on 5 properties right now. You know, so we'll do about anywhere from 15 to 20 flips. We own about, I think we collect on about 20 doors, rents. So we have a good passive income coming into, and everything that comes out of income in that area stays directly in it. We never take a dime. Our retirement fund, it's basically our exit strategy.
You're flipping 15 to 20 properties a year, and then you buy and hold. You currently have around 20 rentals.
We collect on 20 doors. Some of them are duplexes, we have a triplex, so those account for more doors. But we count them doors because that's the rents that come in. So we collect on 20 doors. I believe we own about 15 properties.
Is Mr. Bondi part of that, your REO listing partner? Is he part of these properties that you're talking about, or is this your own individual corporation?
No, he is 100% part of that. That's what he focuses on. He gets a little income on the REO stuff. He keeps really busy on our long-term investments, and he brings a lot of value to me. He's helped me out quite a bit, and we're growing together, and we both have a plan, and that's a completely separate plan, and we look at that every month, and we talk about it every month, and we're on the same page when it comes down to that.
You said you leave all the profits inside, so you're building up retained earnings.
Yeah, retained earnings. So it's pointless to gain, 20, 30% return in real estate and not get the compound of it. A lot of investors go buy real estate and then they spend the profits. Well, if you can do that, just investment in the stock market, that's compound interest, keeps compounding. So if we make $40,000-$50,000 a year on passive income, that's enough to buy another property, putting money down. So we tend to reinvest it into it or buy a flip or whatever it is.
The positive cash flows that come out of that, are you reinvesting by paying down the mortgages or buying other properties?
Right now we're focusing on acquisition. Our profits are so good on them. We profit anywhere from 10 to 30% a year per property. So we're comfortable with that. We don't need to pay down the principals yet. We want to focus on acquisition while the market is low. And then from there, if we have our projected passive income, if it's $250,000, $300,000 a year, then at that point we could focus on maybe depleting some of those principals. But at this point, why throw money that we're making 10 to 30% return on to pay off a mortgage of 5.5%?
What drives you?
My family and the people I work with, my clients, I love them all to pieces. Every single person I work with, I don't want to let them down. If I take on a buyer, I'm taking on a buyer. I'm not going to go off and screw around. I'm there to do a job, and they're relying on me to find that perfect place for them, and I'm going to do it, and I take a lot of pride in it. So, and every time somebody refers somebody to me, it's like a pat on the back for me, and it feels really, really good, and I'm really excited about that. So that drives me. I love when the phone rings. I love giving things to people, and people tend to give that back, and I think that's what it is. The busier I am, the more I could work, take care of my family, and just give.
Daniel, why are you successful?
I think because I'm not afraid to work, and I'm honest, and people see that. If you're not afraid to work and people see that you're looking out for their interest, even though you might not make the most money sometimes being honest, but that goes a long way, in many different ways. I believe in hard work brings good luck, and I believe in good karma, when it comes down to it. I am a religious man, and I do give my share to, my church too, and I believe that by giving you will receive. God put you here to He gives you the blessings so you could turn around and give that back in one way or another. Kind of focus my business and my life around that. And I think people see that they know who I am when they meet me. They don't meet the persona that I want to project. They meet me. I think that's what makes me successful.
If you were to advise a brand new agent getting in the business, what would you tell them to do first?
I would say, of course, start with your sphere, like everybody else says. Start with your contacts, and then start working. Get ready to give up every single weekend. You have to do that. You're going to do that for 3 to 5 years. Make a budget. You know, because if you're financially tied down or financially strained, people are going to see that. You know, and that's one thing I would recommend an agent to do is just put some time into it, put your database together, and get to work.
Well, Daniel, it's true. The harder you work, the luckier you get. And you've been working very hard. Your ability to see gold in the streets when everyone else is frozen in fear has proven to be very profitable. You've designed a business around your philosophy that it's better to give selflessly and multiply the good in the world. Your referral business model is impressive. Thank you again for being our top agent of the month.
You've been listening to the Mastermind Agent Interview of the Month Club, where top agents, rising agents, team members, and guests from across North America reveal their success secrets, strategies, and systems in up-close and personal interviews. You can find all the club interviews at www.mastermindagent.com.